A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Already getting toasty for gardeners out there today. We do have that heat wave this weekend. Whew. Maria Chalais, Tom Bettis, Liz Hamilton with you this morning taking your questions. Our next texter asking, guys, whether neem oil is very effective in controlling pests.
Depends on the pest, yeah.
Okay.
Situational. That's one of my favorite answers when people ask me questions. Like, oh, it's situational.
Oh, it depends. This doesn't work for me. So yeah. What does it work well on? Okay,
well,
one of you.
The compressors on there, you're hearing us like nothing.
Yeah.
Well, it works well for spider mites if it's resprayed. And it's one of those things that it's never going to totally eliminate, but it does suppress a number of things. Aphids, it can. But I've noticed a lot of the neem oil sprays have now started incorporating
permethrin and
piperonyl butoxide, and they call themselves like triple punch because the oil on its own, just they're dosing it up with other things.
Right.
And so you can try to use the oil as a preventative for things like powdery mildew, and it's sometimes effective, but because it's a biological, both fungicide and insecticide, your expectations are lowered. So I think it was Mad TV used to have this segment called Lowered Expectations. It was like a dating service.
Okay.
And sometimes that's what you expect with the neem oil.
Oh.
And so it can be effective. And I know I'm going to get hate mail and
you
things.
Are. Mm-hmm.
But it can be effective, but you need to use good management along with it. You may have to switch over to horticultural soap or something. And so results
can
be...
It's not a one and done, is what
you're
saying.
It's not. It is definitely not.
Yeah. And I think something to think about, too, is like the mechanism of how it works. So a lot of folks will spray, they'll see the label and miss the in-depth on it, which is... It's not an instant kill. So if you go out and you spray neem oil on a pest, that pest isn't going to die instantly. And it's also not going to crawl off somewhere and die either, most likely. How it works is by disrupting the life cycle. And so it by disrupting the insect or mite's ability to want to mate. And so it results in like lowered sex drive for
insects.
Honey,
I've got a headache.
Yeah, for insects. And then that ends
what
up being.
What show is this? I'm very confused.
Yeah. And so that ends up being how it controls. And so it deals with population issues, but not necessarily like addressing the problem instantaneously. So if you go out and you're trying to knock off an entire population of spider mites, it's really not going to do anything for you, but in like immediately, but in like 3 to 4 weeks when that population would have flipped over, you're seeing less of them slowly over time. So if you dose once or even two or three times a summer, you see some control, but you're not going to see complete kill
for
on anything.
When people are using neem oil, I really recommend they use it every 5 to 7 days for around a month to really get results out of it. There's a derivative product called azadiractin, which is much more effective, but they've taken the active ingredient and greatly increased the effectiveness of it. And it's sold as a kind of an organic biological. But when, especially this time of year, if somebody has spider mite problems or aphid problems, I usually direct them to horticultural soap over the oils.
Yeah. All right. We're back to managing expectations, which some of us are not very good at. Okay. Next person wants to know if it's too soon to plant a fall crop of spinach.
No. You could have started a week or two ago, probably.
Okay, let's take a call then from, let's see, we've got Sharon in South Jordan. She wants to talk about cucumbers. Good morning, Sharon.
Hello.
What is your
can
question
you hear
this
me?
Morning? Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, I'm wondering, can you grow English cucumbers in Utah? And if not, what is the next best thing?
By English cucumbers, are you talking about like the seedless, thin
English
ones that are saran wrapped?
Yes.
Okay. So, yes and no. So the ones that you find in the store that are that saran wrapped cucumber are actually a type of variety that produces fruit parthenocarpically, which means that they don't need pollination to produce fruit. So like if you're looking at any of the cucurbits, cucumber squash, they have a male flower and a female flower. And on the female flower, you see the fruit forming underneath it. And then if it does not get pollinated, that falls off, right? So in parthenocarpic varieties, the fruit still forms regardless of pollination. And then that is why there are no seeds on the inside, and then they're very tender. And how those are grown are in a greenhouse with zero pollinator interaction. And that's why you get the seedless, because they can still be pollinated if they were outside and in the presence of a pollinator. And so they would have seeds in them that way. So you can grow an English cucumber here in Utah, but unless you're growing a parthenocarpic variety that does not get pollinated by pollinators, no.
So the answer is probably build a greenhouse.
Well, no. Okay. So what's the next best thing? What's the closest thing to that seedless kind of cucumber?
A lot of the size is going to be, if you let them get too big, the seeds are a problem. But if you pick them
smaller,
the seeds are much more edible. Liz mentioned Armenian cucumbers earlier, and mm-hmm. I really wish more people would grow those because they're just so much easier to grow than regular cucumbers. You can let them get bigger and the seeds aren't a problem.
Mm-hmm. And they're always sweet because they're not technically a cucumber. They're a melon, so they can handle that heat and they're not going to pump out chemicals that are going to make them taste bitter.
Okay.
All right,
that's
Sharon.
That's what I look for. And sometimes they're very hard to find, though.
They grow great from seed. So, and then for $1.50, you can have 20 plants.
Well, I don't need 20 plants. I don't have room for that. But, okay.
Sharon, thanks for your call this morning.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a call from Wes in Salt Lake. Good morning, Wes.
Hello. I have two horse chestnut trees that my grandfather planted in 1920, and they've always had dense shade, but they're not as dense now. The trees still look good, and there's some branches dying. The trees are over 100 years old, but it seems like there's a lot of squirrels up in there. Could the squirrels be affecting those trees?
No, the squirrels are going after the horse chestnuts, and I would more think that the trees are just getting to a point that they have old age and they're starting to decline because of old age. And as those trees age, it's just like us, we get more diseases and physiological problems. And so you could maybe have an arborist, the qualified arborist, take a look at it, like Darrington Tree Services or Needles and Leaves out of Logan. There's several of them out there. Do you know of any good arborist services, Liz?
Owen Tree Care is good. There's a whole bunch of them that have a certified arborist on staff.
But you would want an assessment done on the trees for safety and health. And there might be just some fertilizer could help out. If you went out in mid-March with some lawn fertilizer under the trees when the snow melted off and just did a really early application, that may be enough. But if they continue to decline, I would recommend having a certified arborist with the specific endorsement on tree health look at the trees.
Okay. Just any fertilizer?
Triple 16 or 2000, just, you know, lawn fertilizers have a lot of different numbers, but there oftentimes isn't a great difference from one to another. So, but yeah, just a general lawn fertilizer would be fine.
And put that all the way around.
Yeah, just dose it up like you would fertilize your lawn. And now you need to be careful because if you do pre-emergent, that will take the place of it. But if you don't do pre-emergent in the spring, then just under the trees, that lawn fertilizer would be fine.
All right, Wes, thank you so much for your call today. The number 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. We'll be right back.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up.
they pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Ton and Liz taking your questions this morning. Next texter is wondering about a good tree to plant in a parking strip that won't raise up the sidewalk. Any ideas, Tom?
There are quite a few of them. And just out of durability, I really like hawthorn. They can find a thornless hawthorn or Washington hawthorn. Those will get some fruit on them, but the fruit stays on the tree until you oftentimes right through the winter. And so they're usually not messy, but they will put up with anything. Spring snow crabapple that we talked about earlier. Merrill Lee crabapple is another one that is nearly fruitless that's good.
Okay, and let's take our next caller, and that is Taylor in Farmington. Good morning, Taylor.
Hello. I'm wondering what I want to plant a couple of persimmon trees, and I want an American and an Asian. I was wondering if you had any suggestions on what might be a couple of good trees to plant.
So I'm growing a couple of persimmons, and I'm growing Nikita's Gift, which is a Russian-American hybrid. And so if you're growing, like, Nikita's Gift.
Nikita's Gift.
Yep, and it's out of, like, the Nikita... like plant botanical nursery, botanical gardens in Russia. I think they're the ones who developed it. But they, so American persimmons are dioecious, meaning they need a male and a female persimmon to produce fruit. So the male produces the pollen, the female has the fruit on it. And then Asian persimmons are self-fruitful. So the bigger fruit, larger fruit can eat them when they're less ripe, unlike American persimmons, which need to be completely mush by the time you go to eat them. Otherwise, they're super bitter with the tannins in them, but are self-fruitful. And typically the Asian persimmons, like the Fuyu and such, don't love our winters here. They don't do as well. They're technically marginal. That being said, I do know people who are growing them successfully here and have seen them do okay. So Fuyu is the one that I have seen grown the most, F-U-Y-U. And that it does okay, but knowing that it's marginal and you may see some dieback, making sure it's protected in the wintertime. Asian persimmons are hardy to zone 3, or American persimmons are hardy to zone 3 and can do really well. And just about anything you grow is going to do okay, but keeping in mind that they like a little bit of acidic soil. So treating them with iron in the spring, and then, you know, just an chelate so that the plant can take it up preventatively so that you don't end up with chlorosis later on and then trying to back treat it. But the Nikita's Gift has done pretty well for me so far. The other thing I'd recommend, too, is when you order, try not to order a bare root persimmon. Try to order a persimmon that comes actually in a gallon of soil. I find that the bare root are really unsuccessful here. They don't do well.
Are they fast growers?
Sorry? No, they're not.
Can you buy them locally?
I have seen them at Glover.
Glover, maybe Cooks and Orem if they can get them in.
And Western Gardens maybe as well. I know I did see them at Glover last year. I couldn't speak to this year. And then you could probably also, when nurseries are putting in their special orders, usually in December. So if you went into one of those nurseries as well, you could ask for them to put them in on one of the orders that they're getting ready to order, and then it would be a special order for you.
I'd like to plant a couple of them. So the American persimmons are bitter.
They're bitter until the first frost, and so typically they're harvested when they're mushy, so like end of October, early November, and then you can We've used them when I was kids. We'd pull them off the tree out in the wild because I grew up back east, and we'd smear them on toast right off the tree because they were that mushy.
Okay. How about this? You mentioned, I think, this Saijo, S-A-I-J-O.
Yeah, the Asian variety.
Yes. Is that winter hardy enough for Utah?
I don't know the answer to that one specifically.
Persimmons aren't super common. And so that Fuyu has had some success here, that Nikita's Gift. So, I mean, that's probably going to be about as far as we can get you. There is a rare fruit growers page on Facebook. You could ask. There are a lot of people on there doing some really cool things. Go to Facebook to Utah Rare Fruit Growers and look at that page.
There's a couple threads on persimmons already open. So if you join Utah Rare Fruit Growers and then search the page once you're admitted, there's been quite a few discussions on folks that have successfully grown several different varieties. I think there's a gentleman on there who says he has 23.
All right. We just have a couple minutes left in the show. Let's get a couple more questions in here. How do people control the puncture weed?
Boy, that's one that we may need to talk about next week.
Okay. Let's plan on that next week, then.
Yeah, let's do that next week. So let's just do a to be continued on that because it might take all our time.
8 o'clock hour next week.
Sure.
That's what we'll do right at the top of the hour. Okay, let's take a call from Bob in Cedar Hills. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I got a couple of lilac bushes and some boxwood and firebrush last summer and had them planted. And I was told to water them about 3 times a week. And the other ones did fine, but the lilacs didn't do well. So I looked it up on the internet, and it said that I was watering them too frequently. So I backed off on that. They did well for a while, and then they stopped looking like they were growing. So I called the greenhouse about 5 weeks ago, and the net result was that I probably wasn't watering them enough, and so I started watering them twice a week, a gallon at a time, and they're still not doing well. So, all of the leaves are dying, and although the branches still are flexible. So I just don't know quite what to do. When I look at the ground, it seems dry. The meter that I use that measures moisture says it's slow, and I just don't know how to water these things.
I would put the meter aside and use your judgment. So you're going to have to get a shovel and dig down along the side of those lilacs and see what the soil is like. If it's dry, then water. Yeah. If it's wet, then don't. And I would rather if you put your $5 or $10 in a slot machine than bought that soil meter, because they're so easy to judge once you kind of get some experience that you really don't need them. But the only way you're going to figure out if the soil is moist enough is to dig down and take a look.
Often the soil meters don't work very well after, like, they've been exposed and they stop working for so long after they've been used too many times. So you might be getting one reading and it's inaccurate. So the visual confirmation that Tana's talking about is really important.
Okay. I had another question about my boxwoods. I get a very fine little white spider web on them. And when I knock that off, it kind of has a powdery aspect to it. And I don't know what those are.
Okay, Ton, we have about 45 seconds.
Sounds like spider mites. Could also be boxwood psyllid, which is spelled with a P. Those things are piercing, sucking insects, and they're slowly sucking the life out of your boxwood, either one of them. And so using a treatment that's licensed for either one of those is going to be...
Horticultural soap would probably be the best one.
Because it'll get rid of both.
Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. I want to remind our listeners we have a feature on hydrangeas that's up on the KSL Radio, KSL Greenhouse Facebook page you can check out. Have a great weekend, and we'll take more of your calls and questions next week, Saturday, 8 to 11.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. find it on kslpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.